University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For November 5th, 2015, I'm Carla Javier. But first, a news update with Sebastian Vega.
Today, the California Board of Education approved a settlement in a class action lawsuit. The lawsuit included students from four schools in Los Angeles County. They had been placed in fake classes without any instructional value. Mark Neubauer is an attorney who worked in the case. He says today's settlement provides for what he calls the most basic rights of students and citizens.
The right to an equal education. Whether you go to school in Beverly Hills or in Compton, you have the right to have courses that really mean something, that have content.
Under the settlement, the plaintiffs received $400,000 in legal fees. Also, state officials will help the schools comply with a new law that limits scheduling classes without any instructional content. Former Oakland Raiders defensive end Anthony Wayne Smith was convicted of three Los Angeles murders today. He was charged with a fourth murder of a man in Antelope Valley, but a judge declared a mistrial in that case. Jurors found Smith guilty of murder involving torture and murder during a commission of a kidnapping. Smith will be sentenced in late December. He faces life in prison without the possibility of parole. Prosecutors are not seeking the death penalty. LAPD is on alert as Angelenos join thousands of protesters in cities around the world today for the Million Mask March. From London to Sydney to Johannesburg, activists are demanding an end to government corruption and poverty. Sarah Payton reports on the local protest.
About 50 protesters wearing Guy Fawkes masks associated with the Anonymous movement gathered at City Hall today to air their grievances. The event was organized by Anonymous. The group of hackers and online activists have protested for social justice worldwide. Protesters here had specific demands.
We're here because we're trying to wake people up to the injustices of the system, a system that's inherently corrupt.
This is the fourth year protesters have rallied globally to demonstrate against corporate greed and for civil liberty.
The poisoning of our food and air with the GMOs, and we're protesting everything from the fluoridation of water to the human rights violations that are going on in Palestine. Mainly, though, the mass police state here in America, dude, this has got to stop.
The protest continues until 5 p.m. in every city around the world. For Annenberg Radio News, I'm Sarah Payton.
The NCAA announced today that graduation rates for Division I athletes is at a record high of 86%. Caitlin Plummer has the story.
Overall, USC athletes had an 81% graduation rate compared with UCLA's 86%. But the Trojan football team's rate was lower, at 58%. It was low because it includes data from 2005 when 22 football players joined the NFL before they graduated. USC's Senior Associate Athletic Director Magdi El-Shahawi says the emphasis on graduation rates for Division I athletes is misplaced.
At the end of the day, like I said, we're still working with people who are not going to help our graduation rates because we want to see them get their degrees when they're finished competing in their sport.
He said the university is committed to helping student athletes graduate.
For the students that are still here, we're trying to get them on the base to graduate before they leave, even if they do pursue professional athletics, so that they have their degree in hand.
USC tied for fifth with Stanford in the Pac-12. Caitlin Plummer, Annenberg Radio News.
You already know about smartphones and smart cars, but have you heard of smart poles? Today, Los Angeles became the first city in America to use smart light poles. They include LED technology and 4G LTE wireless, meaning LA residents receive both high-quality lighting and better cell service. Mayor Eric Garcetti unveiled the first 100 poles in Hollywood earlier this morning. He says the smart poles effectively combine smart technology with urban needs.
It'll help us make these streets safer, help us connect to the internet more quickly with our mobile devices, and at the same time generate revenue for the city of Los Angeles so that we can share in some of those revenues that come from telecommunications.
Garcetti says the smart poles are a part of an infrastructure boom in Los Angeles. There are major public transportation projects and a remodel of LAX already underway. In other mayoral news, Garcetti endorsed Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton today and then took it back. But apparently the endorsement still stands. Clinton is in Southern California today holding a series of fundraisers for her campaign, and she's going to be on Jimmy Kimmel later tonight.
Your next deal is going to make you the highest paid writer in Hollywood. Where do I sign?
Are you not, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Later on From Where We Are, we talk with actor Bryan Cranston about his role in the new film Trumbo. Stay tuned. Advocates for recreational marijuana are celebrating a victory in Mexico. The country's Supreme Court ruled yesterday that members of an activist group can grow and distribute marijuana for personal use. As Neha Wadekar reports, the ruling could have far-reaching effects on both sides of the border.
In courts was brought by four defendants who argued that anti-drug laws violate their human rights. The Mexican Supreme Court agreed. And while the court's decision only applies in this case, legal experts predict it sets a precedent that could drastically affect drug policy in Mexico and the United States. Hannah Hetzer is a Latin America expert at the Drug Policy Alliance. She says the ruling is evidence that countries worldwide are reconsidering their strict drug policies.
Things like this have a significant impact because there's now a rift opening up in the world where you have countries that are really beholden still to the strong, repressive, prohibitionist approach, and then a host of countries that are looking for reform. And Mexico has actually led that host of like-minded countries. This domestic move will bring the sort of national discussion up to their international stance, and I think create even more push on the international level for real revision of drug control policies.
What also makes the Mexican ruling unusual is its focus on human rights, which historically haven't been part of the drug discussion in the United States.
Unusual. A lot of the arguments here are centered around over-incarceration, misuse of resources, potential taxes that could from marijuana sales. So this human rights dimension is interesting, and I think we'll create a different look at both drug policy, but also at what's happening in Mexico.
Today, the flow of drugs to the United States continues, as does the political corruption and violence it fuels in Mexico. There's a growing consensus that the hardline war on drugs started in the Reagan era is not working, and it increases the likelihood that drug laws will be reformed. Neha Wadekar, Annenberg Radio News.
Angel City Derby girls are heading to the championships this weekend in St. Paul, Minnesota. ARN's Maria Cavasuto spoke to the athletes before they head out.
The anticipation is palpable for this number 6 internationally ranked team. First up, they'll be facing Seattle's number 15 Rat City Roller Girls. The Angel City Derby girls practice in Gardena at a place they call the Warehouse. Beth Gilbert, or Booty Ninja, said that during practice this week, they focused on their biggest problem, getting penalties when they're not working together.
And so the moment you're not in a position where you have all your blockers on the track or your jammers off the track and you're in a penalty trouble, then the game just kind of gets away from you. So if we can just rein it in quickly and adjust quickly, then we should be able to tackle all of our obstacles.
The phrase that we kept using today was stay the course. Like, just stay through it, stick together.
That's Rachel Johnston, or Rachel Rotten as she goes by on the track. She says it will take teamwork and mental tenacity to make it to the final game.
But I think, at some point it stops being about your physicality and starts being about the mental game and about what you're able to accomplish together and about everyone believing and being on what we call the believe bus to know that you can get all the way to the end and to that final game on Sunday.
Like Johnston, Raquel Davila, who goes by the nickname Satan, is focusing on the mental aspect of the game.
This week before leading up to champs, I'm mentally preparing myself, watching footage, getting ready, preparing for the worst situation possible and getting over it and staying mentally strong through the whole thing.
The Gotham Girls Roller Derby have won the championship for the past 4 years. The Angel City Derby girls hope to strip the New York team of their title.
Hopefully someone beats them beforehand. So just them losing would be amazing. Everyone wants them to lose. But winning the Hydra would be, I don't even know how to explain it. I'm like going to cry thinking about it. I have no idea. Like, I can't even put it into words, really. I mean, it'd be just a magical feeling, and I'd probably just like throw my skates off right there, retire.
The WFTDA final will be streamed for the first time on ESPN3 on Sunday, November 7th at 6 p.m. Maria Cavasuto, Annenberg Radio News.
You may have heard of big-name drum companies like Pearl, DW, or Yamaha, but did you know some of the best drums are made right here in Southern California? Ben Ebert has a story.
Brian Spahn has been building drums for nearly 20 years, and since 1996, his company Spahn Drums has broken into the industry with some of the most unique-looking and best-sounding drums. I spoke with him about the company and got a behind-the-scenes look at the process of building a drum set from scratch.
Started the company about 19 years ago. I've always been a drummer and fell in love, passionate about drums from an early age. But I was always a tinkerer. I really enjoyed like taking apart my drums and figuring out why they make sound, what makes them work. It just sort of grew out of that, really. Double 45 degree bearing edge that I created almost 20 years ago. Our lugs are machined from solid brass, and it's the quality of the build, you know. We make one drum at a time, one drum kit at a time. It's not something that's pre-manufactured where we're gonna go and pick it off a shelf and ship it to you. So it starts with the raw shells, which we have in tube format. From that point, I cut the shells down to the proper size. From there, it goes to finishing. It might get sanded and papered with the inside papered because it's going into the paint booth. Or maybe it goes to the station where we do all the wrap finishes, where it gets glued and wrapped under high pressure laminating machine. Once the finish is done, then it goes to marking and drilling. So we're going to mark it, we're going to drill it, we're going to cut all the bearing edges, and from there it goes to our assembly area where we have all the lugs, all the hoops, all the heads, getting all the parts onto the drums, give it a final test of tuning, check and make sure that there's no problems and it's ready to go into a box and onto the UPS truck. There's a lot of variety. I mean, there's well over 1,000 different drum kits and different sizes, finishes, options from, you know, very simple finishes to very extravagant finishes and everything in between.
After hearing about all the work that is put into each individual drum, I just had to try out a Spahn drum kit for myself.
I'm just going to continue to do what I've been doing, which is try to create great quality drums that are unique in features that people really enjoy playing on.
Ben Ebert, Annenberg Radio News.
If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Emma Delaporte with today's Root Source.
Okay.
Most of us probably don't think about how often we use the word okay. A simple change in inflection can give okay 100 different meanings. Okay can be a question, and okay can be a response.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Perhaps okay will be our always.
Historians aren't fully sure of the origin of this word. Most agree it came from a fad in 17th century Boston where people spoke in abbreviations, much like text talk. Okay was probably the result of this fad in combination with an even stranger one, in which newspaper columnists would misspell things as a joke. Okay was a misspelling of all correct. President Martin Van Buren popularized the term when he ran under the nickname Ol' Kinderhook, or OK for short. His supporters even formed OK clubs. The art of Michael Heiser removes you from the safety of the gallery to the wild of the American West. One of his most ambitious projects, Double Negative, cuts a monumental line through the desert. But few know that the Nevada site is owned by LA's Museum of Contemporary Art. Kelby Vera explores Michael Heiser, this desert masterpiece, and a new film about its inception.
Wilshire and Fairfax, late afternoon. Park the car, feed the meter. You walk past city lights, through the courtyard, and face a monumental boulder in the middle of Miracle Mile. Levitated Mass has become a Los Angeles icon since it arrived at LACMA in 2012. At 340 tons, the sculpture is formidable, but surprisingly, this Michael Heiser piece is the runt of its family. A world away in the red rocks of Overton, Nevada, Heiser's sculpture, Double Negative, dominates the landscape. Although LA's Museum of Contemporary Art owns Double Negative, the piece is too big to live inside a museum. The sculpture consists of two deep cuts wedged across a valley of thick red sandstone. Its scale is massive, crossing 1,500 feet of Nevada's Moapa Valley. A new documentary chronicles the creation of Double Negative and the spirit that inspired it. I spoke to director and art historian James Crump about his inspiration for the film.
This was the perfect time to rediscover these kinds of artists, rediscover the spirit that inspired them and the kinds of risk-taking that was involved in doing these massive projects, and I thought today is the right time to do this.
Double Negative was given to MoCA in 1985, but it is just rising to prominence as public interest in earthwork grows. Piqued by projects like James Turrell's Rodin Crater and Heiser's own Levitated Mass. MoCA's website now shows Double Negative alongside the MoCA Grand, Geffen Contemporary, and Pacific Design Center as one of their four locations, no longer an absent stepbrother. At the premiere of Troublemakers, Crump spoke with Philippe Verne, the current director of MoCA. They discussed the importance of the piece.
There is MoCA, MoCA's collection before Double Negative, and there is MoCA's collection after Double Negative. By doing so, you forced us to do something very special. You force us to care for something which is bigger than us, bigger than the museum. Something that a museum cannot possess, something that the museum cannot contain.
As it ages, the piece is eroding from wind and rain. The negative is being dissolved by the elements. Crump finds something spiritual in the natural degradation of Double Negative.
This is a remarkable mesa. It seems to me odd that it wasn't set aside for some kind of sacrificial, sacred site. There's something remarkably beautiful and profound about just the idea of the mesa reclaiming this piece.
For those who want to capture land art's rebel spirit, Heiser's offspring is only an all-terrain vehicle road trip ahead.
Come to the museum, we give you directions. then take your car, rent a car, and they change the way you look at art and you look at sculpture.
For Ampersand, I'm Kelby Vera.
Ndoume Olatushani spent 28 years on death row before being released because of a lack of evidence. He turned his time in prison into something positive when he discovered a passion for painting. Rasha Ali spoke with Olatushani about his trial and his time in prison.
My name is Ndoume Olatushani. I spent 28 years in prison, and 20 of them was on Tennessee's death row for a crime that I ain't commit.
What were you convicted of?
I was actually convicted of first-degree murder and a robbery charge that happened in Memphis, Tennessee, actually. And the ironic thing about my situation is that, like I said, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, and had never even been to the state of Tennessee, and certainly not in the city of Memphis, before I was actually taken down there and put on trial for it, and ultimately convicted and sentenced to death for it.
What was going on through your mind when you found out that you were put on trial for a crime that you didn't commit?
I really wasn't really concerned about it because it was like, even though it was certainly a serious thing, but I know that I ain't have no involvement and didn't know nothing about it. So it wasn't like I was tearing down the police doors, you know, trying to figure out from what you want to talk to me about.
Do you think having an all-white jury had anything to do with your conviction?
Oh, ain't no question about it. In case the prosecutor used each and every one of their preemptory strikes to get rid of all the black potential jurors and left me with an all-white jury. And that made a difference. It really did.
Did you accept your sentence and just kind of be like, okay, this is what it is and this is what's going to happen, or did you fight back?
I never laid down, so no, I never accepted that.
So the whole time you were on death row, you knew that you were going to get out?
Yeah, I always, certainly there were, you know, moments when of despair, and I found freedom. I found freedom and peace and happiness sitting in a 4x9-foot cell. You know, I was able to find this peace, you know, and come to this realization that, you know, people are always looking outside themselves for something to, you know, make them whole, or, you know, somehow it's something outside of us that's going to make us happy with ourselves or make us better or whatever the case is. And the truth is, it's really not. I mean, we have everything inside of us that we actually need to be everything that, flares to our fullest potential.
How are you able to keep that hope alive?
A lot of it I attribute to my mom. She's was such a strong and amazing woman. And one of the things that happened a couple of years into my imprisonment, my mom was actually killed in a car accident along with a niece of mine. I mean, that just kind of broke me. I was already kind of low. I'm sitting where I was. But when that happened, I was like, I can't be hurt no more. The last time I seen my mom, which was almost a year before that actually this thing happened to her and my niece, you know, as she was going out of the visiting room, I just jokingly said to her, "Oh, girl, I wouldn't know what to do if I ain't had you in my life." And she looked back in the same light and said, "Oh, yeah, you're going to know exactly what to do when the time comes." Of course, neither one of us knew that that would be the last time we would actually physically see each other.
What was it like when you got out of prison and your mom wasn't there and she wasn't able to enjoy your freedom with you?
Right. Man, it was such a, that's really one of the sad, kind of sad points, you know, in my story. I mean, I'm such a fortunate person. I really am. That's really was the sour, still is kind of this sour, you know, aspect of, you know, what's happening for me in life now, that she wasn't actually around to actually, you know, be there.
Most people in prison kind of pick up a hobby or do something to pass along the time.
Right.
So being on death row, I mean, passing the time only leads to being executed. So
right.
Was time even relevant to you while you were in there?
I mean, I sit here with a watch on now, but I was one of them people that while I was sitting in prison, I mean, I didn't even keep a calendar you know, in my cell, and certainly didn't have a watch because none of that stuff really mattered. The time was kind of irrelevant. I guess over the period of time that I was locked up, I'm sure I've read over a couple of thousand books or more. That one of the things that I did, I started painting while I was in prison. Became a fairly accomplished artist, and so that allowed for art in a lot of ways saved my life. It really did.
Okay, so you spent 23 hours a day in your cell and 28 years of your life in prison.
Right.
How do you come out with such peace and happiness?
I feel like I'm such a fortunate person. And even though that I wouldn't have never chose what happened to me, what I vowed was that in spite of what was actually happening to me, I would not let that confinement define who I was and how I was going to, you know, just kind of deal in life. Because like I said, I began to understand that if I'm happy or not happy, then it ain't because of what somebody else is actually doing. It's actually because of how I'm actually dealing with it.
That was Rasha Ali speaking with Ndume Olatushani, who spent 28 years in prison after being wrongfully convicted of murder. Dalton Trumbo's work is a legend in the history of Hollywood screenwriting, but his name is largely unknown among today's film audiences. That's about to change with Trumbo, which opens tomorrow in Los Angeles. Donna Granada talks with star Bryan Cranston and the film's director about Trumbo's legacy.
Sparta Spartacus, a motion picture unequaled in the entire history of filmmaking.
Spartacus, one of Hollywood's classic films. When it came out in 1960, the news that it was written by Dalton Trumbo shocked Hollywood. After all, he was on the blacklist. Trumbo was the highest paid screenwriter during Hollywood's golden age. During the Red Scare of the 1950s, he was labeled as a communist and was questioned by the House Un-American Activities Committee in Washington.
You state your full name.
Dalton Trumbo.
What is your occupation?
My occupation is that of a writer.
Are you now, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Trumbo was held in prison and banned from working in Hollywood. He had to work covertly under pen names. Using the names Ian Hunter and Robert Rich, he wrote the Oscar-winning screenplays for Roman Holiday and The Brave One. In the new film based on his life, audiences can learn about the hardships Trumbo and his family faced under the blacklist.
He's a very appealing character and for me, a beloved character.
Director Jay Roach says Trumbo used his writing to stand up for free speech.
He helped expose the lunacy behind the blacklist and succeeded.
Trumbo is portrayed by Breaking Bad star Bryan Cranston. He worked closely with Trumbo's daughters Nicola and Mitzi to capture their father's essence.
He is so distinctive. He seems like he could be a caricature of himself at times. But the character was everything that we depict in the movie. He is flamboyant and irascible and prolific and generous and defiant and bold and weak and, you know, I mean, he's all these things.
Trumbo's daughters directly helped to reveal the nuances in their father's story.
You want to be able to honor their memory of their father. That's what you owe for. That's the biggest compliment I can get. Better than any critic saying something, it's to have his own daughters saying, I'm feeling like I'm seeing my dad up there, is a great experience.
Youngest daughter Mitzi told the filmmakers how her father helped other blacklisted writers by editing and vouching for their work. Roach says Mitzi pushed him to present a realistic view of what blacklisted writers went through.
She just said, this is the sacrifice these people made. This is the cost to their families. And you might want to get into that battle a little more. And it wasn't just so easy as a couple of guys put their names on movies. They wrote their way out of the hell that was created for them. I'll never be able to thank her enough for kind of zeroing in on what mattered about the second half of the story.
Trumbo remains a polarizing figure for some people. And Roach says that is why this film resonates in today's political climate.
I think this film is about today because it's a pattern in history for fear to become a catalyst to get people to turn on their political enemies. And the new fear that gets exploited is the fear of terrorism. But Dalton Trumbo wasn't trying to overthrow the country. He was a humanist.
During a recent screening of Trumbo, a man in the audience said loudly, the film should be called Traitor, and went on a tirade about how Trumbo's legacy was depicted in the film. Cranston's response was to channel a quote from Trumbo himself.
We both have the right to be wrong. And that's the point, is that that person who said it should be called Traitor has the right to feel that. That's his First Amendment right. And that's the point of the movie. By him shouting that out, just points out the need to have a story like this told so that that opinion, even though it's the opposite of mine, can be heard and should be heard and shouldn't be squashed or oppressed.
When Exodus and Spartacus were released in 1960, screenplays written by Trumbo, he became the first blacklisted writer to have his name appear on screen. It marked the beginning of the end of a dark period in Hollywood history. Donna Granata, Annenberg Radio News.
That piece was produced with help from Brian Welk.
That's it for From Where We Are. We had help today from Kate Dowd, Caitlin Plummer, and Maria Pena. Our board operator is Lexi Macavinci. Martha Daniel is our producer. And for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Carla Javier.